You are listening to a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. Any opinions expressed within are solely those of the participants and do not reflect the views of WRCT Radio Incorporated. Questions and comments can be addressed to the Public Affairs Director at pa@wrct.org or by calling 412-621-0728.
Hello and welcome to the Digital Hazard on this, the 24th of April, 2011. As always, I'm Matt Barron. Eric isn't joining us today because he is busy doing his senior capstone project, whatever. So I'm joined by my producer, Chris, and we are doing this in the Air Studio, amazingly.
Yes, we are. Hello, Matt.
Hello. Can you see the stories all right?
Let me pull them up on this machine. Why don't you start off?
All right, I'll start it off then. So the first story that we have is a PC Mag article that's basically talking about how Greenpeace, the environmentally active group, is criticizing Apple, Twitter, Facebook, and a little bit Google for dirty data centers, what they're referring to as basically opening all these data centers with the intentions of using clean, renewable energy. And they've defined clean, renewable energy as like less than 1% coal-fired and 20% nuclear. But they're criticizing Twitter, Facebook, and Apple for these very dirty, quite literally, coal-fire fossil fuel plants. Twitter's one in San Jose, Twitter's data center in Utah is fired 81% coal, which is actually quite a fair amount. And then Apple's in North Carolina, I believe it's North Carolina, is quite dirty. But when Apple was responding to this, they talked about their facilities in Austin, Sacramento, and Ireland, claiming that those are 100% powered by renewable energy. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, they're still dirty yeah. ones in North Carolina.
Yeah, well, I mean, usually in a situation like this, I would say, Greenpeace, what are you guys talking about? You know, like the whole turn off the lights when you leave the room. How much of a difference does it really make? You know what I mean? But in this case, I mean, I don't want to have to agree with Greenpeace, but I kind of agree with, you know, you do use a substantial amount of energy in any data center. And I'm sure their data centers are quite substantial in size,
yeah.
the amount of data that they're holding and processing and everything like that. So, I mean, I think that I hope they have something to go on here because it definitely seems like it.
Yeah, I mean, the power that a bunch of servers draws is probably quite large.
Yeah, one rack of servers alone can draw thousands of watts or more
right.
of power. So think of, you know, hundreds of these racks.
What was I going to say? Yahoo, however, Greenpeace was praising them because of their quote-unquote chicken coop data center in Lockport, New York, which is designed like a chicken coop, very long, which facilitates airflow, so they don't have to spend as much energy cooling the building.
And that's a good idea.
Yeah.
What does Greenpeace actually want them to do in order to power their data centers? I mean, do they want like nuclear power?
I think they just want renewable resources or renewable energy. They praised Google for their new wind-powered data center outside of. Oregon, somewhere like that.
Oh, a wind-powered
data center. Yeah, so giant turbines on top of the buildings.
That's interesting. I didn't think wind power could actually generate that much power, enough to power a data center, at least.
Well, yeah, apparently.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
All right. Shall we move on to the next story?
Sure, if you'd like.
All right. The next story we have talks about, it's another Apple story, a congressman, by the name of Ed Markey, who's from Massachusetts, sends Steve Jobs a personal letter from the Congress of the United States, House of Representatives, asking him to explain what the France is going on with the tracker file on your Apple products, the ones on your iPad, your iPhone, and I think on your iPod Touch. that basically scrape where you've been, your location, synced back to your Mac when you plug it in, and then synced to your other devices. So the basically the context or the content that this congressman, Representative Markey wants to know from Steve Jobs personally is basically why? Like, what do you use this data for? Is it, like, leftover? Or, like, why? What did you do? Why?
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, when I first heard this the other day, I was like, why? Yeah, the big question was why? Did they actually use this to conduct studies on the network availability? And then why, if that's the case, why is Apple so concerned? It's the AT&T network. Did AT&T ask them to collect all this data? Are they sending it back to the servers? Because if not, then they can't actually do any data analysis on it.
Right.
You know, so it just, it seems ridiculous. But I do like how the LA Times has a scan of the actual
letter.
How do they get that?
I don't
That's
know.
Crazy.
Steve Jobs has a very good publicist.
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't know. I see, like, Mr. Steve Jobs, CEO. One infinite loop always gets me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, wow, that's silly.
Oh, Steve.
Oh, Steve. All right. Well, I mean, yeah, there was a lot of Apple privacy concerns in recent memory and from apps collecting your data and your location and things like that. But, I mean, this really is a very important thing because it's at the level of the device. It's quite literally Apple tracking you. It's not your Twitter app finding where you are, where you're tweeting from, or your Flickr upload thing, uploading your picture location data.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the more important aspects of it is that it's not actually GPS. It's the radio data of where, so it uses the cell phone towers to triangulate your position. And it doesn't even ask you if, you know how like the apps will be like,
right,
would you like to use your location data in Google Maps? And you're like, of course I would. I'm using Google
Maps.
But, you know, it doesn't ask you at all. And this is just an iOS 4 thing, I believe,
yes,
right? So I'm safe.
Yeah, you're safe because you have an old silverback iPhone.
Yeah, but or anyone who didn't update to iOS 4 is safe, I guess. Safe from this problem. But who knows what else is out there? I mean, if this is just surfacing now, who knows what else is out there in Apple land and all the devices, right? I mean, this is a pretty big deal.
This is actually quite very
this
scary.
This is a really
yeah.
big deal. And how do they find out about this? Do we know?
Don't know.
It just kind of popped up out of nowhere from what I understand.
Right.
But yeah, it's kind of troublesome.
Right.
I'm worried about Apple.
Well, I mean, there is a fair amount that you can do with this quantity of location data. There was something I was reading a while ago that was talking about how people have basically calculated relationships between people based on shared like check-in location data at the same time. So, like, if you and I go out to lunch and we're trying to keep it clandestine from other people, but there's location data on our phone, and they say, oh, well, Matt's phone and Chris's phone were both at Panera Bread at, like, 5 o'clock last night. Maybe, like, they actually are better friends than we think they are.
Yeah, I see. Even if we're trying to keep it undercover.
Right.
The location data will obviously show. And that's why you need to keep your phone in airplane mode
all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. And take the battery out too, just in case.
Just in case.
Yeah. That's the safest way to operate your phone.
Practice safe phone.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Moving on to the next story, which is sort of an Apple story, but in a recent survey, they're conducted about like why you would or wouldn't buy a Apple product, so an iPhone or a an iPad, things like that. When given the option, there's no reason, I just hate Apple, a fair number of Android users said that option. There's no reason I don't want an iPhone. I just hate Apple.
Yeah. I don't know. I think sometimes they give off this aura that makes people want to hate them. And out of anyone, I could see the Android community wanting to hate them more than anyone else because it's like all open source Android,
right,
especially compared to Apple. It's like one of the more closed source organizations. So, but yeah, I always try and come up with reasons why I don't like Apple,
right?
You do too.
I do too. Yeah, I have very good reasons why I don't like Apple products.
Yeah. I like this. I know you can't see this because this is in television, but there's this big green android guy on this video that I really want to play and see him dance around, probably.
It's. I actually watched it when I was putting the show notes together. I mean, and you can go watch it if you want. Just go to the blog and the show notes are up. But he actually looks, he dances quite robotically. Like, it doesn't really seem like there's a human in there. It kind of seems like there's a mechanized thing dancing around in this blow up android costume.
Mm-hmm. I think Apple needs a mascot like that.
A dancing Apple?
Does Apple have a mascot?
The Apple.
But that's not, I mean, it's not like a person. It's just, it's a logo.
Well, so is the little android dude. It's
yeah, but he dances around, right? Like a robot.
Well, get the apple to fall from a tree.
No, I don't know. I'm just saying annoying stuff. No, I don't know. But, I mean, why do you have any different reasons why you think Android users say that they hate Apple and have no idea why they do?
Well, come on. If you're given a survey response that's, no, there's no reason. I just hate Apple. I mean, yeah. How tempting is that just as an answer, even if you have nothing wrong with Apple,
that is
if you can mark the answer, I just hate Apple.
You're right. That is a very tempting answer. But why Android users?
Why Android? That's a very good question.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, why not Windows Mobile users? I mean, that competition has existed forever.
All four of them?
Yeah, maybe no one uses Windows Mobile anymore. That's why. I had one of those phones back in the day, and I put Android on it. And it didn't work well. And then I got an old iPhone, and I'm happy now.
Oh, dear. How far have we come?
Yeah. But, I mean, that it kind of makes sense in my mind that Android users would hate Apple more than other people. Maybe just a lot of people have Android. I don't know how they did this study.
Oh, dear. All right. Well, then our next story talks about the EU's decision against stricter net neutrality rules. So the gist of this is there was a bill going through the EU, basically the entire EU parliament, basically advocating better net neutrality rules. If you're listening to the show on the 10th of April, when Tom Merritt was on, we talked a little bit about what net neutrality means. You couldn't prioritize traffic. So if AT&T and NBC wanted to partner up and deliver NBC content over AT&T pipes, it would be prioritized over, say, CBS content, which is scary for small content creators. Probably a very good deal for people who have plenty of money to burn, but it is a very scary thing that, well, why is my information not as important as other people's information?
Mm-hmm.
So basically what the EU has decided is against the harsh crackdown against this tiered pricing type things. So of course the EU hasn't adopted a horizontal bill, which would be akin to what Chile did, which goes beyond the problem of blocking and prevents any kind of tiered internet at all. The EU Commission believed that was entirely unnecessary. But I don't know.
Yeah. I think any throttling or, I guess, prioritizing of certain content should be done primarily on a networking management perspective in terms of like quality of service. So mm-hmm. if say one type of service is becoming extremely popular just because people are interested in it, so say YouTube, you know, explodes and they have such a large network infrastructure and such a large bandwidth requirement that all of that is clogging up all the tubes in the internet. And Skype can't get through because it's right. not as popular anymore, but people still use it, then in terms of quality of service, the backbone of the internet should manage that, which is kind of how IP works already. But there shouldn't be a priority in terms of like policy management because the internet was designed to be a completely open and free architecture. And by making it as commercial as it is now is, I think, as far as it could ever go, just because it's defeating the original purpose of the internet and really kind of masking what everyone wants it to be. And come on, if you give priority on an ISP level to different companies, like only what this is also kind of taking this to the extreme is like blocking one ISP over another, right? I mean, right. You can take that really to that extreme. And that sounds absolutely horrible. Who would want... I guess the ISPs would want that, but they'd lose so many customers. And then if everyone did it, no one would use the internet anymore.
Well, they're going to make up the money by having like NBC or CBS pay them off to deliver their content.
I guess so.
Better, faster.
I guess so. And then they'll have a lot of just random people who don't care using their service, I guess. It kind of turns into AOL.
Oh,
no, I don't know. This just sounds like a bad idea. And honestly, I really don't think this is going to work. Because there's such a strong backing behind, you know, people like you and I who really support the internet being open and free. I mean, just look at the Wikipedia community. I mean, every single person on there is interested in freedom of information. And that's like one of the original foundational elements of the internet.
Right.
So
yes, the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which works for freedom of information and that kind of liberal internet, if you will, they have quite a pull.
Mm-hmm.
They really do.
Well, that's
quite a strong political influence.
That's good.
It is a very good thing.
Good thing. You don't want this to happen because this is really scary.
Yeah.
Think about it. You can't sit in front of your computer anymore and be as anonymous or as free as you think you are.
Well, I mean, you're not as anonymous.
You're not as anonymous.
Already.
You're not as anonymous. That's true. But it feels really comforting when you're sitting in your pajamas in your apartment and no one else is around and you feel like you're all alone doing whatever you want on the internet. That's a whole different story. I don't want to get into that. Unless it's on your list of topics to talk about, and then we'll talk about it.
No, it's not on my list of topics, and I really don't want you to share the story.
No, there's no story behind that.
Okay. we're coming up on the last few stories before we want to take a break, but I'm making quick time, I guess. So the next story that I wanted to talk about was remember how Oracle bought Sun?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember that.
Remember that? Yes, and you know how they inherited all of those nice projects like VirtualBox and OpenOffice mm-hmm. and things like that?
Yeah.
And then you also remember how LibreOffice split off from OpenOffice. Mm-hmm. All the developers from OpenOffice, when Oracle was like, "We're gonna do this," they're like, "No, we don't want to do that." Mm-hmm. So we're gonna see you.
Yeah,
and we're gonna make our own. It's gonna be called LibreOffice. It's gonna look exactly like OpenOffice and do exactly the same things.
Yeah, I remember that.
But it's just not gonna have the Oracle logo mm-hmm. on the startup screen. Yeah. Well, Oracle finally gave in, and they were like, "All right, guys, we're not gonna fight this fight with you anymore. You guys win." We're going to give up the openoffice.org name. You
wow.
guys can have it.
That's a big deal.
It is a very big deal, actually.
Yeah. Why do you think that happened? Were they happy enough with Java? I mean, Java's kind of a big chunk. I was like, you're like OpenOffice, Dropbox. I'm like, Java.
You should have jumped in.
Java. Java. But I guess, OpenOffice has always been distributed as a free platform anyway.
Right.
It is nice that Oracle, I guess. It's nice for them to have OpenOffice, but that's kind of a big deal. I bet they were really happy, these guys.
Yeah. The guys who left went and formed the Open Document Foundation, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they made LibreOffice, which is exactly an entire fork of OpenOffice. And then all the Linux distributions switched over from including OpenOffice to including LibreOffice.
Oh boy, I didn't realize that. That's yeah. a big deal.
I remember there was a thing Ubuntu, like there was, because the LibreOffice, when it came out, the number was like 3.3.
Mm-hmm.
And when they had stopped OpenOffice, they had stopped it at 3.2.
Okay.
So then they just sort of made deals with the repository managers for like Ubuntu and Fedora and all the big name mm-hmm. Linux distributions. So that when they would update OpenOffice, they would entirely rip out OpenOffice and push LibreOffice.
Wow.
Oracle had tried to make OpenOffice financially useful the way that Sun had, because mm-hmm. they would sell like group licenses to big institutions,
mm-hmm.
Universities and things like that. But the fork made Oracle doing that in absolutely financially not worth it.
Well, because of everything else that they owned, it was insignificant.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting. Plus, I guess once all the Linux users stop using OpenOffice, the only person who uses OpenOffice is our exec computer here. Other than that, I don't. I mean, that was that was the main office suite for me. Whenever I had a Linux machine, if I really needed to work with Word documents, I would use that. Otherwise, I would just use Nano. Right. You know. So what else? There are really not that many other well fine-tuned options.
Right.
So it was. That's. I mean, that's a huge deal. Then I didn't realize that. Oh, man.
all right. So Dropbox, you know, the nice file syncing thing?
Yeah.
It finally reached 25 million users.
25 million?
Yeah.
Wow.
25 million users.
That's a huge number. Can we compare that to
Sure,
other...
go ahead.
Oh, I don't have
statistics. Well, what do you, what do you want to compare it to?
I don't know.
It's
the
a
number
Google search away, right?
The number of Facebook users.
Number of Facebook users.
Do we have a statistic on that? I'll look up something, too.
Number of Facebook users... well, you know, that's a very good question.
Is it? Oh, is Google not helping?
Google's not being very helpful. I can tell you that Wikipedia tells me that Facebook made $2 billion last year. But 600 million active on Facebook as of January 2011.
600 million? Jeez.
Wow, yeah.
Compared to 25 million?
25 million Dropbox users.
Dropbox users. Okay. But, I mean, that... difference, I think, is...
I mean, Dropbox isn't a social network.
It's not a social network. And if you think about the amount of data that people are storing, that's
right.
a lot of data.
That's quite a lot of data.
It's not like people are... Each person is storing 1 megabyte of text files or something like that. You know, there's no way...
I mean, when
happening.
You sign up for Dropbox, you get 2 gigs free.
Yeah.
And then you can pay for, I think, 25, 50, and 100 gigs.
Yeah, and who wouldn't want to use up all their 2 gigs?
Well, yeah, and then if you spam your friends and invite them to Dropbox, you get an extra, like, 1/4 of a gig for every friend that signs up.
Mm-hmm.
Damn, I wish I had, like, spammed all of Dropbox users.
Yeah.
You know how much free space I'd have?
That's a lot of free space. But that is an incredible number. I did look up how many Google queries there were per day. Apparently 400 million per day.
Wow.
According to that, that's a lot.
That is quite a lot.
That's a lot. They must have a really powerful SQL server over there in Google land. To support 400, our SQL server couldn't do that.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear. That's a completely different story.
Right.
But so you said 25 million.
25 million users.
That is not 25 million. I'm just calculating how much possible free space there, or how much space there could be. Oh, I didn't have to do that calculation. That's about 50 million gigabytes of data maximum for if everyone was a free user.
If everyone was a free user. Yeah. No one paid for it and no one had invited their friends.
Mm, yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah.
But people do pay for Dropbox, I guess.
I imagine.
Because they wouldn't be around and it would make sense for people who would want more than 2 gigs of data. I'm sure there are a lot of people out there, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Dropbox claims that, 80% of Fortune 100 companies use Dropbox services.
Wow. Like as part of their corporate structure?
As part of their corporate structure.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
To share files for a project or whatever, or personal backup to share between like home and work computers, you know?
Well, I guess that's totally worth it. You have someone else manage the structure of your data in the cloud for you. You don't have to worry about, you know, renting cloud computing space and then figuring out how to store everything.
Right.
Dropbox does it all for you, so you might as well. Makes sense, I guess.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Well, comes with the growth, there's quite a number of stories of Dropbox woes. Well, first off, if the government was investigating your Fortune 500 company, or Fortune 100 company, my bad, and they thought that you were faking tax records and saving your fake tax forms in your Dropbox folder, which, I don't know, not exactly a great idea, but if the government said, you know, we're auditing, like, Happy Fun Times, and we think they're pulling some tax shenanigans, and we think they're storing it in your service, Dropbox would be like, oh, okay, well, here you go. Here's the Dropbox information we have on Happy Fun Times.
Oh, man. Well, first off, what are you doing storing your tax forms in your Dropbox? That just sounds like a bad idea. You should encrypt that if you're going to store it in there.
And
that still seems like a bad idea. And then secondly, this is why I always am against cloud computing. Computing in the cloud, because everyone can see your data and will happily hand it over to any government if they would get in trouble for not doing so.
Yeah.
That... That's sad that happens.
It should be fair to note, to point out that Dropbox If you sign up for Dropbox, the assuasion things that they tell you is that your data is standardly encrypted with, I think, 256-bit AES algorithm.
Okay.
And they say, which is an industry standard used by banks and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've had any real, like, password or cryptography training, you know that that's not exactly the greatest security mm-hmm. encryption that there is. But
plus
I guess it's a trade-off, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It is a trade-off. Plus, that really, I think, would only stop someone else from trying to get into your Dropbox, not from Dropbox getting in your Dropbox.
Dropbox. Yeah.
So that really defeats the whole purpose of, or the entire argument against what happened here, because Dropbox, I'm sure, has access to everyone's files. And if I worked for Dropbox,
I would have access to everyone's files.
Yes.
funny you say how Dropbox has access to everyone's files because...
What, do you have access to all my files?
No.
Oh, good. Okay. You got me worried there for a second.
Well, I'm saying Dropbox has access to everyone's files.
Oh, okay.
Because our next story happens to talk about how Dropbox uploads that, like, 25 megabyte Word file so quickly. I think it's the second one.
Oh, okay.
It's the second one in our show note link here.
Cool.
And what it does is basically what's been postulated is that Dropbox figures out if anyone else has uploaded the same file. And then it basically just makes a pointer to that other person's Dropbox and says, like, okay, well, it's this file, but here are the changes. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, which
it makes sense from their perspective, but
right.
As a user, that is really scary because you're not actually uploading your data to the server. You're making a ridiculous copy.
Right.
Kind of. So, and it's not even identical files, you're saying. You're saying it's files that are slightly different, and then they just save the changes or the difference between the files that exist on the server?
Yeah, pretty much. It says in the story here about the test they did. Basically they took he randomly generates a 6.8 megabit file and uploads it to Dropbox.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads to 7.4 megs of network traffic. All right. Now, he took a 6.4 megabit file that had previously been uploaded to a different Dropbox account, led to only 16 KB of network traffic.
Ooh. Wow.
So what they've postulated is that Dropbox does encrypt your files,
mm-hmm.
But what they do is they basically store a hash of your files, and they see if a new file has a really similar hash, then they'll just copy over and say, here are the changes.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of going about it. And I mean, if it's reliable enough to always recreate your data, then I guess you might as well. But once again, I wouldn't store anything important. You know, me personally, I wouldn't store anything really important that I wouldn't want to lose on Dropbox. But I guess it's kind of defeating the purpose, right?
Because Dropbox is there to save your data
exactly,
that you need.
Exactly.
Yeah.
One way, you're putting things into the cloud because you don't want them. You don't want to lose that data on your end. You're trusting that their hardware would be more reliable than your hardware,
right?
But then again, you're worried about these privacy issues by putting it into the cloud. It's probably safer on your computer. Maybe. I don't know. Probably not even. And this kind of strange stuff happens. But I mean, if it can always positively recreate your data, then I guess that's okay.
I don't know. I feel that, like, Dropbox sort of needs to be a safe deposit box kind of thing. You
mm-hmm.
know, like, my safe deposit box at the bank is mine.
Yeah.
I'm the only one who can walk into the bank with the key and say, let me into my safe deposit box.
Mm-hmm.
Or they have to prove that they're my heir and I'm dead.
Yeah. But, I mean, I feel like if you really want something like that, you're going to have to pay for it. And if you're really worried about your data being that secure, I don't see why you wouldn't want to pay for it.
Right.
You know, if you're not paying for a Dropbox, then what do you really expect? You expect them to save every bit of data on their servers linearly? I mean, I don't expect them to do that. I expect them to do real voodoo magic like Facebook does. It's like smoke and mirrors. Everything's stored in RAM. We don't know what's going on. Do you know what's going on? I don't know. It still works. Whatever. That's basically what Facebook is.
Right.
It's just a big mess. So, I mean, the same thing is here. It's free. They're doing a lot of voodoo magic, and it works. So,
And you're not paying for it.
Like, you're not paying for it.
You shouldn't expect, you shouldn't have these high expectations for a free service. You know?
Yeah, exactly. But that's what happens nowadays on the internet is people, they're like, wow, this is a really cool free service. They have really high expectations and this kind of stuff happens.
It happens. Right.
But just pay. I mean, if you really want a good service, you're just going to have to pay for it. It's like anywhere else.
Well, the even if you pay for Dropbox, this is our last Dropbox woes story here,
okay.
That the authentication is insecure by design. That basically, I could, if you're using Dropbox on your laptop and I have physical access to your laptop and I can copy over files, I can go find basically this key file, copy it over to my computer, and then sign into Dropbox, and Dropbox will look at that key file and be, oh, hey, this is Chris Perrone's key file. Let me make a copy of all his data onto this machine because it thinks that wherever this key file sits must be your machine or my machine or whoever's key file it is.
Is it a standalone like .key file or something really obvious like that, or is it like part of the hex of the executable program or something like that?
No, it's actually, it sits in, I can read it off for you. It's an SQLite database file. It sits in your Windows username, app data, Dropbox, and it's in config.db. And then once you open it with your favorite text editor, you can see the email. This is the account holder's email address. The Dropbox path, which is where in the file system all the Dropbox files are stored, and then the host ID. And this host ID is Chris Perrone's Dropbox, or my Matt Barron's Dropbox, or Bob Smith's Dropbox down the street,
Yeah. So what's the best way of getting around this? Is it for the Dropbox software to encrypt this file given some unique computer identifier for each machine? Is that the best way of getting around this? Or I don't know. I'm trying to figure out how to do that. Because if, say, the file's just encrypted, you could still copy the file from one machine to another, and the other Dropbox program can decrypt it, I assume, right? So it has to be unique to the machine it's on. Something has to be unique to the machine it's on.
Right.
I mean, plain text is bad bears across the board for something like that.
Yeah.
But if you just simply encrypt it with some normal encryption mechanism, it still doesn't seem effective enough. I don't know.
Well, I mean, honestly, my honest recommendation in light of all this Dropbox news is make a TrueCrypt file and put your Dropbox stuff in the TrueCrypt file, because then the authentication, the security, the encryption is all yours. It's all picked by you. The key is randomly generated by TrueCrypt. You have the only password. If the government says, hey, we think you're stealing taxes or doing something bad, Dropbox will be like, well, this is the file that's in the Dropbox, and it's still an encrypted file. You're the only one who has the key, unless they beat it out of you with a pipe wrench. Like,
that is a great idea. I didn't even think of that. I like TrueCrypt. I'm just going to say that right now. So that sounds, I think I'm going to do that.
That is my honest recommendation, because then if I steal your key and I download all your files, it's still an encrypted volume. And I just think it's sort of the best way to go about it.
Yeah.
The only thing you have to worry about is mounting and unmounting your TrueCrypt volume to put things into.
Yeah, which
but,
is really
that's
trivial.
Like plugging a flash drive in.
Yeah, exactly. It's very simple to do that. So, you'll get in the habit very easily if you do use that method. Mm-hmm. So that's a great way of going about it. Good job, man.
All right, yeah. with that, we're going to take a quick music break. It's queued up on the turntable there.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll be back with our segments, 6-Bit Byte, Facebook Frack Ups, and Science and Kickers.
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you fire. Imagine telling what you know.
was Fire by Arthur Brown off of The Crazy World of Arthur Brown. Anyway, let us go into our 6-bit byte. The first, our only 6-bit byte story here, is there's a judge who is basically asking if the Google Maps streetcars Wi-Fi packet sniffing things is actually illegal. So if you remember back, just real quick history here, the Google Maps streetcars that drive around with the big camera mount thing on top and take pictures of your front lawn and people doing bad things, and they blur it out on the streets and mm-hmm. things like that. Anyway, those cars had been basically sniffing your Wi-Fi. They were looking for SSIDs, the names of your Wi-Fi routers, and looking at unencrypted open Wi-Fi traffic. And people got all up in a huff about this because, well, I mean, first off, Google is taking pictures of the front of your house. Mm-hmm. And the second part is they're sniffing your Wi-Fi data. They actually found that Google had people's emails and things like that, mm-hmm. Which is actually quite scary.
Wait, emails like...
Emails.
Like actual
like
messages.
I sent you a message that was like, hey, Chris, we're going to dinner on Friday.
So creepy.
Well, anyway.
Okay, continue. I'm sorry.
The judge is basically asking, well, is this illegal? And Google wrote that open Wi-Fi networks are like radio communications, like AM, FM radios, CB radios, and police and fire bands that are, quote unquote, readily accessible to the general public. And, of course, packet sniffing things like Wireshark and Firebug and things like that are also very, very easily downloaded, easy to run, easy to find a tutorial on how to sniff packets and things like that. Mm-hmm. So basically, Google's argument is that, no, unencrypted open Wi-Fi is just like a CB radio, that if I have the hardware to access it, mm-hmm. then I have just as much of a right to access it as anyone else.
Yeah.
Which is quite scary.
Which is really quite scary. And I mean, do they have a right to access it? Yes. Should they? Probably not. I mean, it's not really ethical, I guess. It's not really ethical for them to sniff other people's Wi-Fi. That's not cool. I wouldn't like that at all. I doubt you listening out there would like that either. But I mean, they're allowed to do that. It is legal because the Wi-Fi band is completely open. It is completely unlicensed, right. So anyone can do pretty much whatever they want as long as they don't cause too much interference on the band. So So that's why you should encrypt your wireless connection.
Yeah, and don't use WEP. You can crack WEP in like 15 minutes. Use WPA2.
No, not that Google is going to crack your WEP. May crap your WEP. I don't know. Not that Google is going to do that. No, but come on. It's just a bad idea. So that's, everyone should just realize that you're not, once again, going back to the brief thing I spoke earlier about the, you know, the internet is not anonymous, always coming back to that. The same goes with Wi-Fi. And you could walk around. I've seen so many articles about people walking around in places, counting the number of wireless networks, looking for open ones just to get on. So why would you want to be a target by making your wireless network an unencrypted network?
Right.
That just doesn't make any sense. And if you're going to pick an encryption, pick a strong encryption because they exist. They're most likely on your devices. So why not use
it? Why not use them?
Exactly.
Yeah. And actually, there was something I saw that with the correct apps, they didn't actually release the apps, thankfully. But they basically just turned your Android phone into a WEP WEP cracking device.
Oh,
so you could walk around the neighborhood and stand outside someone's house and crack their WEP key.
Yeah.
Which is quite scary.
That is really scary. That is really scary. So, I mean, Google, they're not really doing anything wrong by this. Who knows? Were they capturing these packets intentionally? They may not have been. They were probably just capturing all this data and parsed it later.
Right.
And because your data was unencrypted, then they captured stuff that could be bad, like emails that they wouldn't want. I mean, Google doesn't want that.
Google already has all your email.
Google
you
already
use Gmail. Come on.
It was probably being sent to her from a Gmail account anyway. And they already had it. But I mean, Google doesn't want to be caught up in a whole legal battle about stealing people's data by Wi-Fi sniffing. You know, I mean, is it unethical for them to do it? Probably. But if they're just capturing SSIDs, I don't think that's a problem at all, because even an unencrypted right. network will show an SSID. So,
all right. Google, just last note on this here. Google said that it didn't realize it was sniffing packets unsecured Wi-Fi networks in about a dozen countries until German privacy authorities began questioning what data Google Street View cars were collecting, which is quite scary. Leave it to Deutschland, yeah. With that note, we are going to go to Facebook Frackups. All right. The first story we have is just a little bit here. Google and Facebook are ramping up lobbying spending in the Q1 of 2011. So Google and Facebook have been spending more and more money lobbying congressmen to make plans, budgets, and things like that that benefit them. I mean, yep. if you're as powerful a company as Google and Facebook, you're probably going to have lobbyists in Congress anyway. I mean, everyone knows that Johnson & Johnson and GE and things like that, they have lobbyists in Congress. But yeah. it's just a good marker to know exactly how much money companies are spending mm-hmm. on, you know, taking congressmen out to lunch and buying them like $100 steak dinners.
You know, I mean, it makes sense for them to have lobbyists in Congress, but it disappoints me because it's like they're turning into the man. Like all the other corporations. And I'm really disappointed that Facebook, I don't really care. But Google, you know, Google, I liked Google.
Yeah.
And I don't really anymore.
The numbers are actually kind of scary. The article kind of focuses on Facebook a little more than Google, but the numbers here are for both of them. In the fourth quarter of 2010, Facebook spent $130,000 in the quarter. And this quarter, the first quarter of... oh no, it doesn't say that. Never mind. But overall of 2010, they spent $351,000 lobbying Congress. Mm-hmm. And Google spent record dollars on lobbying in the past quarter, shelling out $1.48 million as opposed to the quarter one spending in 2010, which came at $1.38 million. In total, $5.2 million in lobbying in the last year. That is quite scary.
That's a substantial amount of money just for lobbying for Google. What are they lobbying for?
Net neutrality? I don't know.
I guess so. I don't know. It just seems like not as a concrete, point than
yeah,
any
as,
other.
As like GE corporation. Or something
yeah.
like that. Yeah.
I don't know. But maybe it's something secret that will come out in the future. Or maybe it's just net neutrality. I don't know.
Google's defense contracts now. Yeah. I mean, they already have like Google Earth images and, you know, might as well just yeah. like lump them in with DARPA yeah. and see what they can do.
But Facebook? I don't know. They just jumping on know. The bandwagon?
I don't know. Well, Facebook, whatever Google's doing, we're going to do it.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
All right. Our next Facebook frack-up story here is Facebook accidentally turns on all email notifications for some users. So if you go to your email every day and you got like tons of Johnny posted on your wall and Susie commented on Johnny's post on your wall and you're just like, I don't care anymore. well, now you probably got Johnny posted on Susie's wall and liked like that Frankie status was posted on like Johnny's other ex's Frank's whatever. I don't know.
Wait, so these are notifications that had nothing to do with the person who was getting the
notifications? No, these notifications like... I think you're opted out of when people like your status or when people okay. like someone something like that from email notifications about that. But obviously you're still like, Johnny wants to be your friend.
Yeah.
But Facebook turned on all notifications so that Susie liked your status.
Mm-hmm.
That like all the likes, all the really obnoxious notifications that get notifications on the Facebook site but yeah. aren't necessarily emailed to you.
Yeah.
Now you got a boatload of emails about them too.
And that was accidentally turned on. Do they already have email notifications turned on? Do we know about that?
Yeah, I mean, you can get email notifications if like someone friends requests
you. But the people who had this problem already had them turned on?
No, not they were off. Like no matter what your settings were, if you were one of the users affected, you got all notifications, everything.
That stinks.
I know.
I mean, I'm glad they fixed it. I assume they did, but come on, that's annoying. I turned off Facebook notifications a long time ago. Yeah, it's like for a while it was nice, and then I kept getting like all these super pokes and like all this nonsense. And I'm like, I really don't care. Yeah. I don't want it in my emails. Like my personal email turns into basically Facebook. Yeah.
Scary.
But they have Facebook email now, don't they? What's the deal with that?
I don't use that now.
I don't know. I kind of just
So the messages, like if I send you a message, I can now sit at my Thunderbird client and say like chrisperone@facebook.com, uh-huh. and that will show up in your messages thing,
okay.
as if I had gone to Facebook and messaged you.
Oh, okay. And you can actually connect to like an IMAP folder?
I don't think you can actually pull it down. I think you can only send two.
Oh, that makes sense. It's kind of lame, though. So how do you can't correspond? It's just sending a message into Facebook? Is that how it is?
I think so.
Oh. Well, I guess that's kind
of
cool.
Yeah. All right. This is sort of a Facebook story, sort of a science story, but it leads us into a transition here. If you remember, we reported a while back about how Obama and Zuckerberg were going to basically have a town hall meeting at Facebook, and basically what Obama said there, this was Wednesday, the 20th, was that he wants people to feel the same thing about the next internet breakthrough as the United States felt about the moonwalk. The joke is that's one small tweet for man, one giant status update for mankind, but bad pun, I know.
Yeah, I thought he was talking about the moonwalk like the Michael Jackson moonwalk.
No,
we're talking about
we're talking about Neil Armstrong.
Oh, the first step on the moon.
Moon, yeah.
Moonwalk. Oh, okay. It's still a bad joke pun or whatever he's trying to get at. I don't really like it.
All right. Well, you know, I just.
I don't really know what to say about this.
Don't know what to say about it either. I just thought I'd throw it in there that Obama is trying to get behind the idea of internet development and breakthroughs and things like that, that it really should be a national priority. It's sort of the science education, the science breakthroughs that the United States has nowadays. I mean, we don't have the Soviet Union to compete with.
Yeah.
So we're not focusing on physics and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Computer science has replaced natural science.
Yeah, I would like to see more computer science projects, I guess internet breakthroughs, being owned by, you know, the United States as a whole, kind of like, you know, back in the day. So I can understand where he was going with this, but it just seems a little strange that he made that comment, that's all.
Yeah, no, I understand.
Yeah.
All right, with that, we're going to go to Science and Kickers.
She wanted me with science. She blinded me with science.
All right. We are back with science. We have two stories, and then we're going to let you go on your day. First story here is a kind of a weird one. You wanna pull this up just so you know what
I got
I'm
it.
Okay, great.
Is this the 9-volt one?
This is the 9-volt
one. Oh
yeah,
I love 9-volt batteries. They're really magical things. I gotta say.
Well, speaking of the magicality of 9-volt batteries, your Duracell, you know, electrostim therapy, scientists are basically saying it can boost learning. That participants in the study that were jolted with 9-volt batteries directly implanted basically retained information better than the control group, which is interesting.
That's, they implant the 9-volt battery?
No, they just... It's electrostim.
Oh,
so
electro-stim.
The 9, you just like put a hat on that connects to your nerves and things like that.
That's where do they put that in your, like, how is it actually connected? What is it connected to in your brain?
Nerve endings, I guess.
Nerve endings. Are they like pads that wrap around nerve endings or something like that? Or is it just like two wires that kind of connect to nerves? I can't really visualize what
it
would look
like, either, no.
Which is why I'm kind of confused of how it makes much of a difference. But I guess out of any cell, I could see the 9-volt being the more magical cell because it just, I don't know, the 9-volt battery just always, to me, seems like a magical cell. I mean, the contacts are both on the same side, right? You could put it on your tongue and test the voltage of the battery just like that. I don't know. It has a very ridiculously low current draw. So it would be perfect for brains. I guess, so you don't get shocked.
And you can take them apart and get quadruple A battery cells.
Yeah, there Some you the, go. The I forgot end. About yeah. that. That's a cool thing to do. Yeah.
Don't try that at home.
wear eyeglasses whenever you're using pliers. Or
sure. Yeah.
No, but basically, there's a little diagram here about where like the you wired things up in the brain.
Oh, I didn't see that.
And yeah, so if you hook it like seems to be above the left eye to the right temple, it stimulates the anoid of your brain, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which has been associated with improving working memory and verbal fluency. Which I guess I need some stimulation there because I can't. Jeez, oh, these words, what do they mean? And if you connect from like the center of the brain to the back of the brain, you get alterations in visual perception have been noted under both cathodal and anoidal stimulation of these occipital lobes. And then motor control is from the left, the right eyebrow. No, the left eyebrow. I don't know. I can't do the back
We're
thing.
We're kind of inside the brain right now.
Yeah, we are kind of really inside the brain. That will stimulate motor control, has been proved to affect, positively affect people who've suffered by stroke, and improve movement for arms and hands.
Interesting. What really bothers me here is the amount of current they're talking about, 4 milliamps, which in an electronic circuit is not very much, but in a brain it seems like
a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Because whenever I heard of electrical impulses in the brain, it's always like microamps, I guess. It's significantly low. It's like you couldn't actually power anything like an incandescent bulb with that or even an LED, but 4 milliamps in the brain for as long as 20 minutes,
it says,
for the motor control. That's a long time. I don't know. And for a lot of current and for the brain, I think.
Yeah.
But I guess when they do like electroshock therapy, like, do you ever see that episode of House where they put the things in the brain and he's like, crank it up because it's, and that was a substantial amount of current,
right?
More than 4 milliamps. So I guess that's okay.
So do you think we're going to see kids in class with these hats on with hooked up to 9-volt batteries?
You mean as like a normal thing to do for normal people? Or because this seems reasonable for someone who needs, you
right,
know,
like you're recovering from a stroke.
Yes, then it seems very reasonable.
Right. To do.
I mean, it's still a surgery. You're putting things in your
brain.
But I mean, if it's deemed necessary, then I can understand that. But just the average person being like, I want some increased motor control today because I have gym class, putting on a hat in class, it just seems, I don't think that's going to happen.
Scary.
Yeah, I mean, if you could somehow do it from the outside, then sure. But I doubt that's going to happen. It doesn't seem like it.
All right, our last story before we send you on your way. Gordon's up with a good show, I imagine.
Mm-hmm, as always.
NASA ponies up $270 million for commercial spaceflight. So this is sort of going in the vein of the SpaceX program that was like $1 million for the first person who gets something in space and comes back down, which went to SpaceX, I think. And then they partnered with Virgin Galactic, Richard Branson's company, you know, Virgin Mobile, Virgin Media, things like that.
Yeah.
To make Virgin Galactic. So that plans went to there, which was initially funded by some other DARPA maybe, but now NASA's getting into the outsourcing business.
Mm-hmm. Why not? I guess everyone else is getting into it.
That's kind of scary.
Yeah, that is kind of scary. So what exactly did they, what did that $270 million do?
Well, they're just putting it up as like a reward, if you know.
Okay, I see.
Interesting. They basically, the Asian Ritchie recently inked a $753 million deal with Russia to have Russian transport to the ISS between 2014 and 2016, but now they want American-made vehicles.
Mm-hmm. To take them there.
To take them there. Because the space shuttle is retiring.
Yeah.
End of an era.
That's going to be a real problem, though.
Yeah.
So there you go, Virgin Galactic. I guess you're up.
You're up. All right. With that, we're going to end the show. If you want to give us an email, please do. The email is thedigitalhazard@wrct.org. Check it every week. If you want to call in and tell us what you're thinking, leave us a voicemail, 412-294-8347. As always, you can find links to the amazing diagrams, the Android robot doing his jiggity thing at the show notes, on our blog, thedigitalhazard.tk. And with that, I'm Matt Barron.
I'm Chris Barone.
Reminding you to beware the digital hazard.